Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast, Procedural Defaults and Mitigation Investigation Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On November 7th, 2017, the Supreme Court heard argument in Ayestas v. Davis, a case involving the extent to which Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 3599, which allows indigent defendants to obtain reasonably necessary investigative services in connections with issues relating to guilt or sentencing, applies in the context of procedurally defaulted habeas claims. Manuel Ayestas was sentenced to death for murder, and his conviction and sentence were affirmed on direct appeal by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 1998. Ayestas then sought state habeas relief, claiming ineffective assistance of trial counsel because his attorney had failed to bring Honduras-based family members to Texas in order to testify to Ayestas' good character and lack of criminal record in Honduras. The Texas State District Court found that Ayestas' trial counsel, though ultimately unsuccessful, had acted with reasonable diligence and therefore denied habeas relief. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals affirmed in 2008. In 2009, Ayestas sought federal habeas relief under Title 28 of the United States Code, Section 2254, claiming that his trial counsel had acted ineffectively by failing to properly investigate all potentially mitigating evidence. An effective investigation, Ayestas argued, would have uncovered his lack of criminal record in Honduras, his schizophrenia, and his addiction to drugs and alcohol. The district court determined that Ayestas had procedurally defaulted this claim by failing to raise it in state habeas proceedings and found no cause to excuse that default. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit denied a certificate of appealability. In 2012, however, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Martinez v. Ryan that the ineffectiveness of state habeas counsel in failing to claim ineffective assistance of trial counsel may provide cause to excuse a procedural default. Although the Fifth Circuit denied Ayestas' motion for a rehearing based on the Martinez ruling, the Supreme Court vacated that judgment and remanded Ayestas' case for further consideration in light of the Supreme Court's 2013 decision in Trevino v. Thaler, which made clear that Martinez applied in the context of Texas state procedures. The Fifth Circuit, in turn, remanded Ayestas' case to the district court to reconsider his procedurally defaulted ineffective assistance claim in the first instance. On remand, Ayestas filed a motion for investigative assistance under Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 3599F, requesting a mitigation specialist in order to develop his broader ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim. In 2014, the district court denied habeas relief, concluding that neither Ayestas' trial nor state habeas counsel had been constitutionally ineffective, and that a mitigation specialist was therefore not reasonably necessary. Ayestas therefore moved to amend his federal habeas petition to add claims relating to a recently discovered prosecution memorandum, suggesting that the push for capital punishment in Ayestas' case was improperly motivated by his national origin. He sought a stay in federal court until he exhausted these new claims in state court. The district court denied all relief and denied a certificate of appealability. The Fifth Circuit affirmed in all respects. The Supreme Court granted Ayestas' subsequent certiorari petition to address whether the Fifth Circuit erred in concluding that Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 3599F, withholds reasonably necessary resources to investigate and develop an ineffective assistance of counsel claim that state habeas counsel forfeited, where the claimant's existing evidence does not meet the ultimate burden of proof at the time the Section 3599F motion is made. And now, to discuss the case, we have Dominic Dre, Solicitor General of the State of Arizona.
Full disclosure, I serve as the Solicitor General for the State of Arizona, and we filed an amicus brief on behalf of 15 states supporting the respondent. Perhaps unsurprisingly, I'll refer to that brief quite a bit during this discussion. This case is interesting because it arises at the intersection of two important habeas issues. First is a defendant's right to funding for certain types of mitigation evidence, and the second is the exception to AEDPA's waiver rules contained in a recent decision called Martinez v. Ryan. The first of these important issues rests on a provision codified at 18 U.S.C. 3599. That statute provides that indigent criminal defendants may seek funding for, quote, adequate representation or investigative, expert, or other reasonably necessary services, end quote. Those services are detailed in the following paragraphs, including mitigation evidence, which is provided in paragraph F of section 3599. At issue here is funding for mitigation evidence based on the defendant's mental health. The petitioner claims that mental illness and a history of alcohol abuse should have mitigated the death sentence he received for his role in a 1995 homicide. His trial counsel elected not to pursue this argument. Among the reasons for that decision was the petitioner's instruction that his lawyer not contact his family members who were living in his native Honduras. Only much later did the petitioner change that instruction, and he also began to exhibit schizophrenic behavior. Again, all of this after the sentencing was complete. After a series of appeals, he finally presented the argument in federal court that his trial counsel was ineffective for failing to develop the mitigation evidence, the importance of which he sought to demonstrate with the help of financial support provided under Section 3599F. So that brings us to the second doctrinal issue in this case. In 2012, the Supreme Court decided Martinez versus Ryan, a case originating here in Arizona, actually. And a year later, a related case called Trevino versus Thaler, which extended Martinez to every state. In those cases, the court held that ineffectiveness by post-conviction counsel could excuse a habeas petitioner's failure to raise the ineffectiveness of trial counsel in the initial state habeas proceedings. As a result, petitioners are able to raise ineffectiveness claims for the first time in a federal habeas proceeding when new claims would ordinarily be barred. The idea is that the right to counsel is foundational and that the initial habeas proceeding is the first time when a prisoner can raise it, that is, the ineffectiveness of trial counsel. So new ineffectiveness at that point in the initial state proceeding should not be a bar to raising the ineffectiveness of the original trial counsel. That's the intuition behind Martinez and Trevino. So to synthesize these points, Ayestas asserts that his Martinez gateway claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel entitles him to funding under Section 3599 to investigate the mitigation evidence that his trial counsel did not pursue. So I'm sure you've got all that. And with that, we can move on to the procedural history here. The Fifth Circuit denied Ayestas' request, reasoning that neither the gateway claim, that is, of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, nor the funding request were meritorious. In doing so, it applied a substantial need test that is allegedly at odds with the test in other circuits. I believe it's the Fourth and Sixth Circuits that have rejected substantial need. The Fifth Circuit requires a showing of substantial need in order to qualify for funding under Section 3599. And it's that holding that gets appealed to the Supreme Court. So at the oral argument, petitioner's counsel began the argument by announcing his preferred test. He asserted that funding should be provided if it, quoting now, would be used to identify or develop possible claims by a reasonable attorney representing a paying client of ordinary means, end quote. That's a logical place to start, the argument, that is, advocating for one test over another, but the Chief Justice immediately jumped in with other ideas. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts began the questioning by focusing on the argument advanced in the 15-state amicus brief that our office prepared. That argument points out that funding cannot be reasonably necessary, to use the words of 3599 statute, if it is being used to develop a new theory that was not presented in state court. In particular, 28 U.S.C. 2254E2, a provision of AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, prohibits petitioners from advancing new claims unless they result from a new rule of constitutional law announced by the Supreme Court or from evidence that was previously undiscoverable. Remember that petitioner's theory in this case is that his counsel was ineffective for failing to develop mitigation evidence. That, of course, assumes that the evidence was discoverable, and 2254E2 bars claims unless the evidence was undiscoverable. So the Chief Justice's opening question is how it can be reasonably necessary to develop a theory that is barred by this other provision of AEDPA. Again, that's the position that the 15 states joining Arizona's brief argued would be sufficient to refuse funding here under 3599 because it can't be reasonably necessary to spend money on something that's already barred. Petitioner's counsel, with an assist from Justice Ginsburg, relied on the fact that Texas had not argued this point in the lower court. The Chief Justice nevertheless responded that it would be available on remand and seemed to think that the test for reasonableness whatever test it is, whether it's the necessity test in the Fifth Circuit or some other formulation, might need to account for other legal obstacles to advancing the claim for which the funding under 3599 is sought. Justice Alito raised another obstacle to petitioner's case, and one to which Texas devoted significant briefing, but it seemed to get very little traction. That theory was that funding requests are administrative rather than judicial functions, akin to the hiring of law clerks, for example, and therefore not subject to appellate review. Petitioner's counsel responded that the amount of funding is in fact administrative and reviewable by the administrative office of the courts, but this case presents the question of whether funding is available at all. He also distinguished between the administrative review that is available for funding under the Criminal Justice Act, which applies to non-capital cases, and the capital process under 3599. Justices Breyer, Ginsburg, and Kagan also rallied to the petitioner's aid on this point. Justice Breyer pointed out that a district court's decisions in how to administer a trial are always reviewable, but subject to such a deferential standard that challengers never really win. Justice Kagan pointed out that Texas's theory opens up the possibility of a division in the way that circuits handle funding denials, but a division that the Supreme Court would be unable to resolve. That was in the context of the Texas argument, but neither lawyer saw much interest in the Texas jurisdictional argument beyond Justice Alito's initial question, which is, as I said, only interesting because it was the lead argument that the state of Texas made on behalf of respondent. Returning now to petitioner's argument, the court finally took up the question of what Section 3599 means when it says, quote, reasonably necessary, and whether that explanation of the funding standard is different from the Fifth Circuit's requirement of substantial need. Justices Ginsburg and Alito both questioned petitioner's counsel on this point, with Justice Ginsburg pointing out that some inspection of the claim's plausibility seems to be implicit in the requirement that funding be made available only when reasonably necessary. Justice Alito likewise asked whether petitioner's own test, that is, what a reasonable attorney would do with finite resources, assumed that the attorney considered a certain type of evidence necessary, which again is the Fifth Circuit's formulation of the test. Justice Alito then threw in a real gem for the law nerds of the world, joking that this isn't the necessary and proper clause or something where necessary doesn't really mean necessary. Petitioner's counsel seemed okay with most of these points, but protested that the Fifth Circuit erred in speculating on what a lawyer might find in his investigation. The justices were not sold on this distinction and returned to it a couple of times. Counsel eventually stated that a reasonable attorney would seek additional facts in some cases when the Fifth Circuit had denied funding. When you listen to it, it sounds like petitioner's argument here amounts to a quibble with the way that the lower court applies its test rather than a difference in the test itself, and particularly on whether reasonable necessity would involve some inspection of the claim's viability. On this point, even some of the more liberal justices seemed interested in teasing out a limiting principle that petitioner would hopefully supply. Justice Sotomayor asked what would happen if an attorney wanted to conduct an investigation because claims of a certain type are often fruitful. You have to think that she's talking about mental disability here, but there's no evidence, at least pre-sentencing, in a given case. Petitioner's counsel, obviously mindful of the case at hand, proposed that a reasonable attorney would not need any basis for seeking the funds if the thing he sought to investigate was something like a necessary social history for which Iestas was requesting funding. It seemed a bit like he was proposing a rule that was somewhat specific to the case at hand. Counsel granted that there might be some requests for which the absence of any indication that the investigation would bear fruit might make the request less than reasonably necessary. Turning now to the respondent's argument, Scott Keller, the Texas Solicitor General, began with the jurisdictional argument I mentioned a bit ago, namely that funding requests are not judicial acts and therefore are not subject to appellate review. He met immediate skepticism, especially from Justice Breyer, who asked why it wasn't a legal question, what the test is for reasonably necessary, words that appear in a statute. Keller's response focused on the fact that amounts are unreviewable by statute, and it would be a little odd to say that it's a judicial act to award no funding, such that appellate review is available, but an administrative act to award too little, or I suppose too much, money. That's fair enough, but the court didn't seem particularly moved by that argument. The justices were much more interested in the effect of Section 2254E2. That's the provision that bars claims based on evidence that was previously discoverable, which I discussed a bit ago. Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor asked about waiver, to which General Keller responded that the argument wasn't waived because it answers the question presented. That is, there's no error because funding for barred investigations cannot be reasonably necessary. So, if the question is whether the Fifth Circuit was wrong, even if the state did not expressly rely on this 2254E2 argument, Texas's position was that the argument itself is not barred because it answers the question presented, and the issue surely is raised about whether or not this was a reasonable use of funds. He explained that the petitioner agrees, or seemed to agree at oral argument, that there is a look at the merits of the claim inherent in the 3599 funding analysis. According to the state, that's enough to make relevant any provision of law that might render the investigation pointless. Hence, a reasonable attorney would not spend money on a claim that is barred, or for that matter, speculative or duplicative, which are the other elements of the Fifth Circuit inquiry. The Chief Justice picked up on this point with one of the more telling questions of the day. He asked whether, in light of the limitations in 2254E2, does the court even need to settle the standard? This seemed to dovetail with the point that Justice Alito had made earlier concerning the uncertainty over whether the Fifth Circuit is actually doing anything different from what other courts are doing, even if it's doing its analysis under a slightly different name. What followed were a series of questions about the particular case at bar, including whether the state contested both prongs of Strickland, that is, both deficiency and prejudice, and whether the state's theory would render Martinez and Trevino meaningless. On the latter point, the state explained that Martinez is a narrow exception to court-made rules governing default, whereas Congress here has announced a statutory standard for funding requests. Takeaways from the oral argument: perhaps the most interesting feature was Justice Kennedy's silence. That's especially surprising given that he was the author of the Martinez decision. Even without Justice Kennedy's active questioning, however, I'll venture a guess as to the possible outcomes, in part because it drives me nuts when SCOTUS Cast doesn't at least attempt a prediction. So I suspect that the court says that the text of the statute provides the relevant standard, that is, what does a reasonable attorney think is necessary, and that such a consideration may take account of other provisions of law that might make further investigation pointless. You might see some fracturing among the justices on the question of how to interpret necessary. Justice Alito seems to think it would foreclose investigation of claims that a reasonable attorney would consider weak, while Justice Sotomayor seemed to think that certain investigations like social history are always necessary. I'd be surprised if the court passes on whether the Fifth Circuit has been doing anything different under its substantial need test. A simple remand for reconsideration in light of the court's opinion would likely suffice for that. So that's my prediction, and perhaps it'll succeed, and perhaps it'll fail spectacularly, and I'll realize why most commentators don't take guesses at these things.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.